first episode of the Film Stage Podcast. I'm Jordan Raup, and with me is Dan Mecca.
Hey, what's up?
And today we're going to review two different films, Tom Ford's A Single Man and The Hughes Brothers, The Book of Eli. But first we're going to talk about some recent events in the film world. Most recently, the Golden Globes was on last night.
Hell yeah.
And Avatar.
Took it big. Took it hard.
Yeah, best drama and the Hangover.
Best drama and the Hangover. Best comedy, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, Golden Globes, let's preface by saying this. It's not like the be-all and all of awards, obviously. And
It's just kind of a fun show to watch. Yeah, exactly. It's like kind of a party, really, or whatever. I mean, it's what it is. I mean, kind of, you know, like Robert Downey Jr. won for Sherlock Holmes. You know what I mean? Like, which I didn't have a problem with, but I'm just saying, you know, there's not an Oscar nomination in this future, right? So,
yeah. But I mean, I thought I probably my favorite part of the show was actually Martin Scorsese's tribute.
Exactly. Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro
introduced him. As hell.
Yeah.
As
so if you haven't, if you haven't, if you didn't watch the award show, definitely check that out on YouTube. And they kind of
definitely
it was actually a really nice presentation, especially with a great montage.
And the thing about Martin Scorsese, which is great, is you know he speaks well. Obviously, he writes well. Obviously, and it's not prolonged, you know, it's not, I don't know, long-winded, you know what I mean? Like, he went up there, said what he needed to say, thanked the people he needed to thank, talked about why he was getting the award, essentially, which is one for being an incredible director, but another for helping with film preservation, and he talked about that, and, like, so really, it was immediate, it was a very good speech.
Yeah. So if he just was up there for the rest of the show talking about film, I would have.
Well, I mean, me and you, and probably half the people. Yeah, but I mean, just in terms of like polite.
No, it's not
polite. Yeah, he was definitely good about it. You're right. Totally.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't talk too much about TV, obviously.
No, film stage.
But Glee won for best comedy.
Right, that was big.
Crazy, and what, Mad Men.
Mad Men, yeah, which was nice. I did think. And we were talking about this. I did think Dexter was going to take it.
It was nice,
because it was such a hit. It was such a big season. It, like I had gathered like almost double the viewers or some crazy thing. And then Michael C. Hall won, and John Lithgow won. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's nice to see Mad Men win. That's definitely my favorite show on television. So
yeah, and now for best actor drama, do you think Jeff Bridges can? Because he won last
year.
Yeah,
I mean, for what it's worth, like we said, Golden Globes are Golden Globes. So. But for what it's worth, I think that this is kind of a good indication that that enough people have seen Crazy Heart, right?
I think that's what I was interested about.
You know, yeah, that's like the question, you know, it's like, have enough people seen Crazy Heart, da-da-da, you know, like, yeah, so I think the answer is yes. I think that Bridges, unlike Mickey Rourke, will have enough steam to get to the Oscars and take it home. You know, like, well, I mean, not to hate on Rourke, but like, you know. Bridges is kind of Hollywood, you know, a Hollywood icon. I mean, he's you know, from a long line of performers, and he's been acting since 1974.
I mean, since the '60s,
yeah, even
with the standing ovation.
You're right. I mean, like this is his moment. I feel like, and I don't think anyone's really going to stand in the way of that. So it was nice to see.
And now on the actress side, do you think Sandra Bullock is going to?
Yeah,
that was kind of crazy.
Yeah, well,
Carey Mulligan.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what you have to remember is Meryl Streep wasn't in that category, and I really, really think that she's gonna win this year. As much as I really kind of am scoffing at that, and I am just because I loved Carey Mulligan. I'd love to see her take one home. I guess Sandra Bullock. No, though. I don't know. I think this is definitely, if this showed us anything, it's that she's definitely going to get nominated. Yeah. I think when people first started saying, like, The Blind Side, could you get nominated for a movie like The Blind Side? And then people were like, well, it's not even a bad movie. Like, it's surprisingly good, surprisingly self-aware and smart. And she is, like, she carries that entire film. So it's kind of like this just really impressive performance in a very, you know, kind of modest studio film, which is in a good way. And so, yeah, I think she deserves a nomination, and I think she'll get it. I don't think she'll win, though. I think it'll be Meryl Streep.
I hope. And, just a few others. I mean,
What'd you think about Ricky Gervais?
Ricky Gervais. He was hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I liked him because he didn't do too much.
Yeah.
He went out there, made a joke, boom.
It was rough, too. I mean,
like rough around the edges with the beer, you know, and the Mel Gibson joke was really funny. I don't really know.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, and what's funny is, it seemed like, I guess I don't really know how rehearsed it is, but like it seemed like Mel Gibson didn't know that joke was coming.
That's why I like the show.
You know, because like Ricky Gervais ran away. You know, he didn't even like stay to shake his hand because I wonder if he didn't know like how it was gonna go over. And Mel Gibson handled it like a pro.
Yeah.
You know, like a non-anti-Semite. And you know, and he did a good job. And yeah, but you were saying that you liked it because of that?
Yeah, I felt very free. Like, just the offhandedness. Kind of, I mean, it's supposed to be a fun show.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's no musical numbers. It's supposed to be like a show where people are drinking, they're talking while people are presenting. Like, fuck it, right? Yeah. Like, that. It's supposed to be that show, so.
Yeah, he did a good job.
Yeah, he did.
And, I mean, James Cameron winning for directing for Avatar, I think he deserved it, I think.
I was a little sad. You know, a lot of people were tweeting last night. I do agree. I was a little sad to see Catherine Bigelow, Catherine Bigelow, not win, but I don't know. I have a hunch that she will pull it out in the Oscars.
I mean, her locker didn't get a single award.
Yeah, but there's something. But like I've been saying, there's something inherently political about the Academy Awards. I mean, that just kind of is just a lot more apparent than the Hollywood Foreign Press. Like, who are they even?
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? But like the Academy, I mean, these are friends of people nominated. These are bosses and coworkers. I mean, so it's really, I mean, it's like a popularity contest in some respects. And I feel like they're gonna. I feel like the Academy wants to have that moment where people can look back in 2009 and say that was the first time a woman won a Best Director statue. You know what I mean? Like, and I think Catherine Bigelow is more than qualified to get to like have that title. So
yeah, we'll see. Yep. I mean, nominations.
But I think Avatar is definitely gonna, I think like if anything, it kind of showed that Avatar is definitely going to pull it out in Academy for Best Picture.
Definitely agree.
But
all right, so Golden Globes.
Yeah.
We'll see. I think early February the nominations get announced for Oscars, and then March 7th is the ceremony. So we'll see if things transfer. In terms of that, all right.
But yeah, so you know, we'll just talk about before we review one or two news stories that have interested me and Jordan just kind of individually, and one that really interested me just because of the source material involved is the Playlist put up an article about Joe Carnahan, which if you guys don't know who he is, and you know, you might not because he's kind of fallen off the face of the earth. He is the writer and director of Narc, which is a great little movie, cop drama with Jason Patrick and Ray Liotta and Busta Rhymes, who's awesome in that movie, actually. And he did that. That got him a lot of street cred, so to speak. And then he did... Did he do anything in between? He did Narc, and then he followed it up with Smokin' Aces.
Yes.
Which, though... Oh. Well, no, so he produced Pride and Glory.
Yeah. Well, he wrote Pride and Glory.
He wrote Pride. Well, so here's the thing. He's like a hard boiled writer, right? I've seen his movie that kind of got him some props: Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane. Which it's like it's like a Pulp Fiction kind of boondocky rip thing off. It's not great. I don't really like it. But that's the kind of filmmaker he is, right? Like he does shit like that. And Narc was really like you know. For him, I mean, really, just great. I mean, it's a great movie. You know, I bought it. Like, you know, like I really responded to it. And then, yeah, Pride and Glory has moments, okay, but it's a mistake. Yeah. And then Smokin' Aces is a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, the greatest thing about Smokin' Aces is that it costs like $27 million, which is like, when you watch it, it does look like it costs a lot.
And it was enough for a sequel.
It's not, yeah, right.
To video
it was, and this is the segue. It was enough for a sequel. Smokin' Aces 2, Assassin's Ball, which Carnahan was an executive producer on, which probably means that he got paid. And but anyway, I mean, either way, the Playlist was reporting he was on a press tour for the movie, which I didn't know.
And he also has the A-Team coming out, which is huge.
Right, we directed the A-Team, right? That's right. I just forgot that. Yeah. But anyways, yeah, so he's talking about the A-Team. Anyway, he's talking about upcoming projects, and he brought up this long gestating project he's had called White Jazz, which is based on the James Ellroy novel, which I've read the majority of it. I never actually got around to finishing it, but it's called White Jazz, and the project's been around. It was, like, in pre-production at one point. George Clooney is supposed to play, I believe his name is Dave White or something like that, who's the the head detective. I mean, for those of you who don't know, James Ellroy wrote the novels, L.A. Confidential, like, you know, those kinds of, The Black Dahlia, novels like that. So he's been adapted bad and good, you know, before by high-class directors like Curtis Hanson and Brian De Palma. So he was talking about that, and he was saying how he's determined to get it made. He thinks he can get it made for $12 million. And if there's anything about Carnahan, like we're saying, he can make a movie on the cheap. And I would just love to see that movie made, because this is kind of another segue to my In Defense of Keanu Reeves article. In that article, which I just posted a couple of days ago, I say how one of the reasons Reeves is respected is because he diversifies his roles, whereas a guy like George Clooney, who's good at, like, absurdist, you know, slapstick and, you know, conflicted leading man, probably better than most. I've never seen him really play a bad guy, and maybe he will in The American, you know, the anti-Corbin movie, where he's a hitman, but it seems like not really.
Yeah.
So in this, and I've read enough of White Jazz to know that this character, this detective, if they're true to the novel at all, is really just a bad person. Bad person. He's corrupt. You know, he's a know-it-all, whatever, but he's dirty. You know, he's a dirty person. And I would just love to see Clooney play that. So, for that, for the sake of that beautiful casting and that, like, anti-role play, I would love to see White Jazz made. And hopefully James Ellroy can get the money together. And hopefully A-Team will get him the money to make White Jazz.
Do you think if A-Team is, like, huge, do you think he'll go back to a smaller $12 million movie? Or do you think
that's right. You know, I wonder. Yeah. You know, because if... Yeah, I mean, if the A-Team is a hit, will someone, you know, will Warner Brothers give him $30 million to make White Jazz?
He had Killing Pablo up.
Right, Killing Pablo, which we had at one point at Christian Bale and Javier Bardem, which is about Pablo Escobar. But that fell apart. That's right, okay, reading it now, Chris Pine was also going to be in White Jazz, but then he blew up in Star Trek, so now you couldn't probably make a $12 million movie with George Clooney and Chris Pine, so. Yeah. But yeah, hey, best of luck to Carnahan. Hopefully he makes another Narc, you know, a Narc-worthy movie.
Yeah, so. Definitely, yeah. All right, now a new story that, two new stories actually that came out this week, both involved Mark Forster.
Man.
And after he went into kind of big budget with Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
And he has two...
Big budget action.
Yeah, big budget action. And that didn't really go over so well. Mm. I mean, financially, it was, I think, the most successful Bond movie.
Yeah, but it was also the most expensive by, like, so much.
Yeah.
It cost $200 million.
Yeah. So we've been waiting for... He was going to do World War Z.
Right.
And then he had this other movie called Disconnect. It was kind of like a technological thriller.
Right, type, yeah. But never seemed like it had a chance.
Yeah. But now, first, a project came up, which is...
The Chancellor Manuscript.
Yep, which is by Robert Ludlum, who
wrote the Bourne books.
Yeah, and so this movie, Mark Forster is interested in doing, and he's interested with Leonardo DiCaprio to start.
Well, Leo's been attached to the project for like 5 years, so I guess he
produced it. DiCaprio's going to produce it.
It must be a good book.
Yeah, and Peter O'Brien is adapting it, who he worked on Halo Reach, the video game series.
Really?
So it's kind of weird that a political thriller on Halo, I wonder how those...
Well, Halo's very...
So political.
So political. The undertones are just...
This project is about... it's basically this novel about DC power brokers who are blackmailed into altering U.S. policies. It says when some operatives get a hold of the manuscript, they think he has uncovered their actual scheme and try to hunt the author down of his manuscript. So it seems...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it seems interesting. It seems more... I would rather see Mark Forster do this than go... I've read World War Z, or listened to the audiobook, and it doesn't... I don't think it'll...
Yeah, I've read it. And it's... What's funny about it is, if you were going to make that into a movie, it would be like District 9.
Yeah.
You know, like the way that they made District... I mean, this is a different story, but like kind of the way they made District 9 would be the way you'd make World War Z, because it's written fictionally, obviously, but it's written as though it's after a non-fiction transcription. Right.
And it's the guy that's writing it is...
It's all interviews and... Yeah.
The guy that's writing the script, though, is the guy that did Changeling and Ninja Assassin, Straczynski.
Same guy did Changeling, did Ninja Assassin.
Yeah.
Oh, J. Michael Straczynski.
Yeah, J. Michael Straczynski. And so... Yeah, I'm interested in that, but then a few days later, it was announced that Mark Forster is attached to
MGP, son.
Yes.
Which stands for what?
Machine Gun Preacher. And this is a film which Gerard Butler
is interested in. He wants that machine gun.
Yep. And this is, he plays Sam Childers.
Yeah, and this is based on a true story, which I guess maybe you could find it even on backlogs of Dateline on NBC. It's Sam Childers, I think. He was a former drug dealing biker tough guy who found God and became a crusader for hundreds of Sudanese children who've been kidnapped and pressed into duty as soldiers. So it's pretty much like the Apostle meets Blood Diamond meets Sons of Anarchy meets The Mission meets Blood Diamond.
Did I say
Blood Diamond? No, yeah, so it seems like almost too much.
Yeah, I wonder if Jar Ball, I don't know. After 300, he hasn't really impressed me.
I mean, and it's funny, Nick, but one thing that, well, we got this story from Deadline Hollywood, and what Nicky Fink said, which is an interesting thought, is Jar Ball had a great year financially, right? Ugly Truth was a hit, for what it's worth.
Gamer, not
so. No, whatever. But we don't talk about Gamer. just like you don't talk about All About Steve with Sandra Bullock. You have two good movies and one shitty one, like, you just don't talk about the other one. But, even though that was his best, like, critically. But anyway,
Law-abiding citizen.
Yeah. The law abided, and law-abiding which, citizen.
I think it's up to, like, almost under 80 million.
80 mil, it cost 50. A lot less than that, so. So, and what Nikki Fink said was she. It's funny because most people would take that success and get a big $200 million project to headline, you know, to kind of prove their worth or whatever. And Butler's going the other route, and he's doing something passionate, something independent. You know, Mark Forster probably like 20, 30 mil or whatever. Yeah. And for that, I respect him because if he is passionate, maybe he will put in a really great performance. I mean, for example, I have not seen this film, but I've always heard. Because I always argue that Gerard Butler is really not a great performer. But it was people always respond with this. Well, have you seen Dear Frankie? Which, have you seen it?
No.
Exactly. It's like this independent British-Irish movie. And it's about, I think, Emily Mortimer's. It's this whole thing. But anyway, it's a small romantic drama. Family drama. And he's apparently great in it. And so that's the kind of movie I feel like maybe he's most passionate about. So if he goes that in that mindset with Machine Gun Preacher, it's kind of hard taking that title seriously. But maybe it'll kind of remind us all that he was good.
I would almost like to see, you know, Forster go after a Machine Gun Preacher, just, you know, because it take a chance, you know, why not?
Right, I mean, it's
if,
so
if he
crazy.
Does a Ludlum novel with
Leo, frankly, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, it sounds interesting, but I kind of thought it was better. Like, just because I've never read about the project, but I've always heard about it because Leo has been attached for so long. And, I mean, it's always been on IMDb and everything. And, like, that's all it is. It kind of makes me, like, meh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, meh. Yeah. So, I don't know, Machine Gun Preacher. but who knows? I mean, Mark Forster made Jay and Barry's life seem really interesting, even without the pedophilia. And, you know, so, hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, so, I'm sure it'll be announced. I mean, he...
So, like, moral is Gerard Butler's one of the best actors in the world.
Yeah, that's how we're gonna end
That's what we've come to the conclusion of.
No, so we'll see. I mean, Mark Forster, he's bound to announce something soon. He hasn't done
anything. Yeah, no, I'd like to hear an announcement for sure.
Yeah. All right, so moving out of news and going into reviews.
Boom.
Boom. Now this film,
it's been around for a while.
Yeah, debuted at Toronto Film Festival. And then
Venice.
Are you sure?
Yeah, because Colin Firth won.
Oh, he won. Venice, I was just going to say. He won the... So, okay. Yeah, so Colin Firth won Best Actor at Venice.
Yes,
and now, Dan, do you want to talk about A Single Man?
Yeah.
Just the intro of what it's about.
Yeah. So A Single Man is written and directed by Tom Ford, who is a fashion designer. He took over Gucci in 1994 when they were on the brink of bankruptcy, and he introduced a lot of different new revolutionary fashion jeans in particular. I think like tight jeans. I can't really remember exactly what they were. But anyway, he took Gucci from really the edge of darkness, if you will, and brought them back, and now they're thriving. And he stepped down in 2004, so 11 years or so. And he's obviously very rich, very accomplished, you know, a genius in the fashion world. So he finally took on this passion project of his, called Machine Gun Preacher. No, I'm just kidding. called The Single Man, which is based on the Christopher Isherwood book from the 60s. Because you guys don't know who Christopher Isherwood is. Don't worry, I didn't before we recorded this podcast. He is a writer. He's a gay writer back in the day who wrote a collection of short stories about his time in Germany that ended up becoming the inspiration for the musical Cabaret. So for those of you who've seen Cabaret, you know it's about a gay writer who, you know, he is introduced to this underground world with Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli, la 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 la. It's very interesting stuff. That's Christopher Isherwood. One of his lesser-known books, a very short book called The Single Man, told the life of a man in 24 hours, a gay college professor a gay British college professor of English in Los Angeles. Within 24 hours, and he's very sad and depressed and just kind of trying to get on his life because his lover of 16 years, Jim, died several months earlier in a car accident. So this is the adaptation of that novel. Ford takes some liberties, obviously, and all of that. But I think it's a very honest and very beautiful, well-rendered adaptation of the source material. And really, it's Ford utilizing his best tools, you know, his eye, his visual eye, his sense of pacing. You know, I mean, not the movie, not the narrative of the movie, because there is no real narrative, which is a problem, but the actual pace of the camera, you know, it really works. I really enjoyed it. There's some problems, we'll get to them, but yeah. Colin Firth carries the film, you know, Tom Ford's lucky to have him. What did you think?
Yeah, this A Single Man is literally beautiful in every
sense. One of the most beautiful movies I've seen in a long, long time. Yeah,
cinematography, sure. Score.
Yeah, score, I mean, great, beautiful, yeah. Score. Yeah.
Everything. Anyway, but as you say, the narrative, I that's the only shaky part.
This does hark back actually to our conversation about the Lovey Bones last week. The book itself is kind of without narrative. It's really a portrait of a man in 24 hours, and so, you know, who's to blame? You know, I don't know, but I'm just, you know, just to be clear about that. But,
yeah. And a lot of people, you know, when you talk about film, the number one thing, I mean, we took editing class, number right, one thing right. is to evoke mood.
Right.
And this film, I mean,
it does.
The whole time.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah. I mean,
there's really... scenes, they go, there's, you know, scenes in color and that go through time for, Colin Firth's day, and while right. you know he's really depressed and stuff,
yeah.
and then there's flashbacks with that feature him and Matthew Good, different parts of their relationship,
yeah.
and
yeah, Matthew Good plays
Tom Ford does such a great job of when they show the flashback and they come out of it, you literally are like
you're taken aback,
you're like, oh, like, my god,
right?
Like,
yeah, you insane. Feel like.
And if there's any, you know, homophobic people, this will kind of convince you that.
Well, yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah, like, no, it is. I mean, in a way, it is similar to A Brokeback Mountain, which kind of, it doesn't skirt around the fact of the gayness. It doesn't victimize comfort. I mean, you know, it doesn't do things that kind of would offer a reason to not like it. You know, like Brokeback Mountain was a love story. You know, it was a love story with two men. It really wasn't. It was a great love story. This is similar. I mean, this is a story of lost love, and it's about two men. You know, Matthew Good and Colin Firth were both straight in real life, as far as I know. So, I mean, this is why Isherwood, and what I appreciated about the adaptation was the reason Isherwood's book was at first kind of ignored, and then now, over the years, respected, is because it just showed a gay man being a gay man
yeah.
in a society that didn't necessarily like them. But it didn't, like, there's not a scene when Colin Firth gets the shit beat out and people are like, faggot, you know, like, there's nothing like that. And in the book, there's nothing like that. And I like that Tom Ford was able to, Tom Ford is gay, just to clarify. You know what I mean? He respected Isherwood's novel enough to kind of keep that sentiment along in his movie. And yeah, it's just beautiful. There are scenes that are washed out during the present, and then something will happen, someone will say something, an action will occur, and color will like be literally breathed back into the scene. And I've heard of some people I know over film spotting, they said that was a little bit much. But under the pretense that this entire movie is a little bit much, yeah. You know, like the score I said is a bit too big for the movie, and I mean even the act, everything about the movie is almost too big for the movie. So considering that, I had no problem with it. You know what I mean? He went all out in every way, so I don't have a problem that he went all out with, you know, not washing out, and then jumping into color. So yeah, I mean. I don't know what else stood out with you visually.
Yeah, visually, there's a lot. They use slow motion a lot.
And yeah, that might have been the one thing that I.
Yeah, there's a couple scenes where I liked it. Like there's a scene where he's driving,
right?
And there's children. There's his neighbors.
That was a good scene. Jennifer Goodwin was the main girl, and he's just not that into you.
Yeah, there's a couple shots like that I love. Like there's a neighbor that's always like playing with a gun and shooting him, and he kind of like does it back to him. And there's, there's a particular flashback in black and white by Beach.
Right.
That's beautiful. Beach, yeah. There's an odd scene where he goes to the guy at the phone booth.
Right.
And there's like an...
That was interesting.
But I love, like, the color, every shot in that movie. Right. With it is really a beautiful film.
It is. No, I mean, and... I mean, you know, if you're going to give Avatar the leeway... then you got to give a scene. You know what I mean? And that's kind of how I feel about it. And this is a much better story. You know, I mean, even though there's a lot less of it in terms of just strict narrative. So, I mean, you know, I think that Tom Ford... And yeah, and the thing about Tom Ford, which is so great, is he is very much a leader. You know, he's a businessman. He's a fashion man. But he collaborated, and he went out of his way to make sure he got the best people to collaborate with. You know what I mean? He got the set designers from Mad Men. He got the, I cannot remember the composer's name, but I think it's Abel, I'm going to swap him last name. Yeah. But he got this guy whose name is Abel Korzeniowski.
Yeah.
Abel Korzeniowski. He got him, this guy who's kind of very... just a very capable score, you know, composer. Anyway, so, like, he wasn't afraid to say, hey, I need help, right? You know, I need help. I need people to really help me with this project. So I admire Tom Ford.
Now, what do you think about the supporting performances from Julianne Moore and Nicholas Hoult?
Well, yeah, Julianne Moore plays Charlie, who's Colin Firth's kind of best friend. She's also British. Mm-hmm. They once were together, but, you know, Colin Firth was kind of, you assume, in the midst of realizing he was gay and kind of trying to maybe not be, but obviously that was a failure.
Yeah, I like the way Tom Ford actually explains a lot of stuff through the flashbacks. Like, you know, in some movies it's kind of, you know, in your face, right. or it's like too much. But like,
yeah, too much.
But, you know, because, like, through, you know, the present day, as it is in the film, it's kind of mysterious, some of the relationships, and then when they go back in the flashbacks, it kind of explains his relationship.
And it is also nice how the flashbacks, the way that it moves backwards.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's no secret. He died, you know, Jim dies, he's dead in the beginning of the movie, so it's not like, that's a spoiler. Mm-hmm. So it starts, in the flashback, the first flashback is his death. Okay, and then it goes back.
I was actually wondering about
ends,
that.
And then it ends when they meet.
Did he, was that, okay, because the film opens with a car crash, it opens with him swimming in titles, right. But then there's a crash. Is that was just a dream, right?
Because
he didn't actually visit when he...
No.
Okay,
no,
that's what I thought.
A dream, yeah.
Yeah, but that seems beautifully handled.
Right, yeah. And that snow, a lot of it was computer generated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because at the end it says in the credits, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But Matthew Good...
Yeah, Matthew.
Talking about supporting characters, there's Matthew Good as Jim, Julianne Moore as Charlie, who I didn't feel was given enough, really, to do, and did it a little bit too much.
Yeah.
And then there was
Nicholas Hoult,
who is the boy in About a Boy. He's also in Skins from BBC. He plays Kenny,
yeah.
Who is this one of Colin Firth's students, who's just very forward and clearly has kind of an affection for George Falconer, who's Colin Firth. And he was a disappointment.
Yeah,
I really did not like him. But just to say, Matthew Good is not getting any credit for this movie, and I like it. It makes me angry, kind of, because, like, really, you know, he really, I mean, I was talking to a friend about it, and every time there's a flashback, I was excited because Matthew Good got to be in the movie.
Exactly, yep.
And, you know, just because he made Leap Year doesn't mean we have to lambast this guy, that we don't have to ignore him.
And no, this whole shift at the end of the movie, it leaves kind of Matthew Good's, I mean...
Yeah, and embraces... And
Nicholas Holt, and it's kind of a new... Yeah.
And just, unfortunately, you can... I mean, I feel like we're in the same thing, so you can take this away. Unfortunately, yeah. Nicholas Holt just...
Yeah, he just doesn't...
Yeah.
He doesn't do much, and what he does is not... Yeah. It's not pleasant. I don't know.
I mean, and I have to wonder, maybe Tom Ford... I mean, because this is his first movie, maybe, you know... He's not an actor's director. You know what I mean? Like, you always hear, for example, we always hear Mark Forster. You always hear that he is a good actor's director. Like, he's good at getting good performances out of his actors. I've always heard that. At least like Monsters Ball, all these movies, like Finding Neverland. You know, getting that performance out of Freddie Highmore, for example. Incredible, right? So, there wasn't any of that with Tom Ford. I mean, Colin Firth is just a professional. He's like a theater actor, right? So, you know, he could probably just do that sleeping. And Julianne Moore is one of the best actresses, really, in the world. So, you know, they're going to hold their own. And obviously Matthew Good will, too, we found out. But Nicholas Holt, I think he needed, I don't know, he needed guidance, you know. And it wasn't there. And the writing, which is probably one of the weaker parts of the film as a whole, he couldn't elevate everyone else could. So it just, everything kind of fell flat. And it was kind of like, ooh. You know, and then the movie, it really, he's in it for more than I thought he was.
Totally.
And it's just,
Yeah. I mean, the scenes where he's not talking and doing, like, the scene, there's a scene in the ocean.
And he's supposed to look beautiful, right? And he does.
He does that.
He looks, like, godlike, right? And, like, he's shot godlike. He's got this golden bronze. Uh-huh. And every time he's in a frame, it's, like, this golden, like, whatever. And, I mean, yeah, that works. But, unfortunately, like, when he speaks, it's just like, you know what I mean? And you're like, oh, okay. But how do you feel about that? I know a lot of people are kind of complaining that it's almost too much beautifulness for a movie that's so...
I don't know. I like that. I wanted to see this at Toronto, and then, you know, couldn't. I was excited to see it, but I had no idea. I watched the trailer once, maybe. A beautiful trailer, by the way.
Right, one of my favorite trailers.
And so I wasn't expecting a lot, and it did a lot more emotionally for me than I thought. After the film, I was kind of like, for a couple hours, I was like, wow, like, you really, Comfort is just amazing.
Yeah, and
Tom Ford.
In a way, it's like kind of a shame that Colin Firth, who's never won or been nominated, and Jeff Bridges are both gave these just tour de force performances this year at the same time, because it just, I would love to see Colin Firth win for this, just because he is a great actor. I mean, it's one of those things when you go back and you look at roles like in Bridget Jones's Diary, or even like Love Actually, where these are movies that are whatever's.
Pride and Prejudice miniseries.
Pride and Prejudice miniseries with Jordan's girlfriend just made him watch all five or seven.
Six hours of Pride and Prejudice, and guys, Void. Void.
He's no Matthew McFadden from the movie. No, but. No, like, he's a great actor. He really, really is. He always is present, you know, and that sounds like a stupid thing to say, but he's always present, you know, like...
The thing with this movie compared to, Colin Firth compared to some other movies this year, like, there's no great monologue in the movie, or, you know, there's
exactly.
You know,
like his best...
George Clooney and
I don't know if you agree with this, but, like, one of his best scenes in the film is when he doesn't really say anything, and it's this scene, it's a flashback that happens early on when he receives a phone call from, I guess it might be Jim's brother or some family member who's not Jim's parents, that Jim died in a car crash because Colin Firth wasn't with him. And his family, obviously Jim's family, doesn't approve of this homosexual relationship. So George Falcon, or Colin Firth, has to hear that his lover of 16 years has been killed in a car accident, and be polite about it to this guy who clearly doesn't like him and is doing, like, a big favor, calling Colin Firth, like, in secret. And then, after all this, he asks about the funeral service, and the guy, the guy who's been nice, but clearly, he says, you know, it's for family only. And, like, it just, and really, Colin Firth has said next to nothing, and it is brutal.
Yeah.
Like, literally, some of the best acting I've seen this year and last year. Like, it hurts.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's not Tom Ford. You know, that is that is a fucking, you know, that's Firth. Man. That's fucking Firth.
But,
you know?
But like we said, Tom Ford adds all these elements to the movie that just kind of elevate the performance to something. Yeah, that's
definitely insane. I cannot wait to see, and hopefully he will make another movie, because I would count the days. He definitely is someone to watch.
So, wrapping up A Single Man, definitely see it. It might be, I mean, if you enjoyed Avatar, you'll like this, obviously.
If you like visuals, you know, I mean, this would be like comfort food.
There's no motion capture, unfortunately. Yeah.
I mean, and honestly, I've been telling all my friends who I know, mostly girls who love fashion, I've been telling them, go see this movie. I mean, because even if you kind of don't get involved in the story, which would be, you'd be not human, or the character, rather, it's only 95 minutes, you know, and it is really beautiful to watch, so.
Yeah, I was kind of, that's the thing about the runtime. Like, when it ended, I was like, whoa, like, that, it flew by.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Good. Every shot.
It's right. A nice movie, really.
Nice. So, moving on, another film opened, well, Single Man just opened wide, but another film opened this week, The Book of Eli.
Now, this is
Albert and Alan Hughes' return after, what, 9 years?
From hell, yeah.
Yeah. And,
I believe they directed something, actually, for New York, I Love You.
Oh, okay.
But first feature.
So this is first time screenwriter Gary Whitta.
Yes. Check out our interview with him on the filmstage.com.
Yes. And he, I know him through a forum, and he's a very nice guy. And this is his first, first debut.
Pretty true. Yeah.
Yeah. And he comes from a video game background, which you can definitely see in the film in some of the sequences. Right. And, this tells a story, Denzel Washington, he plays, Eli, and, it's kind of set in a post-apocalypse.
He has a book.
He has a book, yeah, and it, throughout the film you learn he is on this mission from another god.
It's God. He's on a mission from God.
Yeah. To deliver this book, the sacred book,
Spoilers on the book.
Yeah.
Just kidding, but you could probably figure out what the book is.
Yeah, so, like The Road, this actually reminded me of The Road very much, but it's a lot more crowd-pleasing.
Glitzy. I mean, which sounds funny, but glitzy.
Yeah, so...
Once Mila Kunis enters, it becomes glitzy.
Yeah, I was wondering, how does she get so beautiful?
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Yeah. So this film, Gary Oldman is also a bad guy.
Whose name, I do love his name, Carnegie, which is like, because he's Monopoly, he's monopolizing his name. I mean, it's what I got from it, Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah.
Steel Tycoon. Anyway, keep going. So, Oldman is the bad dude.
Yes.
Eli's a good dude.
Yeah. And this is a very stylized film. You can tell. I think there was either a graphic novel or comic book that like Gary would have worked on before, and he kind of that's how they translated it to film. Yeah. And you can definitely or some of the artwork. I've seen a lot of like the artwork based on it, and it kind of translates. In terms of how it came out on the film, is very precise. And, talk about just initial thoughts.
I was curious of this movie. Mm-hmm. It's been, anticipated, you know what I mean? Once it got pushed to January, I was like, ooh, it got pushed to January, what does that mean? But then, once every great movie got pushed, like, potentially great movie got pushed to January, you're kind of thinking, well, I guess that doesn't matter anymore. So I got more excited, and then it got pretty good initial reviews. You know, Alex Billington saw it; he really liked it. You know, so people were responding well to it. I wasn't expecting too much, just because it looked like The Road dumbed down, essentially. And I have to say, the thing that I'll remember from this movie, probably the only real like thing I'll remember from this movie, but this is not a slight, is the action sequences, which are really, great. Like, really great action sequences. Clear, well-choreographed. I mean, better than any Bourne action sequence, you know, because I prefer to see all of the action, you know, and understand it, as opposed to the jumbled-up kind of a thing. The two Bourne sequels is what I mean. You know, because even though that action has its place, I mean, literally the action sets are pretty much done in one shot in these movies, and it's beautiful. Like, Denzel Washington, like, doing his own stunts mostly.
Yeah, he did all
stunts. He kicks ass against all these people, and it feels realistic. I mean, in a way, it's, you know, 15 people surround him, and then they'll all come on him. You know, part of that phraseology. They'll all come at him. They'll all come at him. They'll attack him. And It doesn't feel like Power Rangers, where it's like one guy at a time. It does feel like he's figuring out a way to beat everyone at the same time, and just the weapons are awesome. Yeah. And so on that level, like, it is a success. Like, it's an action film. It is a fucking thrill ride. And so, and then at the end, they used the red camera for this. Yeah. There's a shooting sequence which literally, it's like they're going up to the guns as it's firing into the camera and then coming back, and like literally with each round, there's like kind of a Western standoff at the end. So with each round fired on both sides, you have the camera going back and forth really without cutting, and it's really well done. Really well done. So
yeah, I agree with that. And I like, there's a lot of, the only thing that felt kind of repetitive were the shots of, there's a lot of shots of Denzel walking. I think that takes up 20% of the film.
Me and my friend Connor, or our friend Connor, we developed a drinking game while watching the movie, in which, and you should play this, even if you're going to the theater, every time there's an overindulgent slow-mo shot of Denzel Washington walking in the apocalyptic desert, you have to take a drink. And then every time there is an overindulgent close-up of Mila Kunis walking, or just being Mila Kunis, you have to drink. So you will get drunk in this movie, without even getting to Mila Kunis.
Yeah, totally. Now, there's a film. This film has a twist at the end.
Which I appreciated.
I appreciate it. And a lot of religious overtones. I was actually kind of surprised after watching the trailer.
I was a little surprised. Yeah. I thought that the book was going to be more of kind of a gimmick, a plot device, even a MacGuffin. But it is not.
Yeah, so I think you want to get into it, kind of just talk about.
Do you want to go spoilers?
Yeah, do it. So spoiler warning from here on out.
Seriously.
Yeah,
seriously, because it'll ruin
the entire movie.
So you don't want to listen to it.
Yeah. So for those who maybe saw it and didn't understand, no, we'll just kind of talk. I'm just going to talk about what. So Denzel Washington has this book.
It's the Bible.
It's the Bible. Gary Oldman is dying to get this book, and he's trying to do. He's been
searching for the words.
Yeah, he's
to say.
Yeah. The whole thing is, this town that's set up is, a lot of them can't read. There's Gary Oldman, and I think there's like four or five people that can actually read.
Really, actually, they make it seem like Gary Oldman's the only person who knows how to read.
Yeah.
Before Eli gets there.
Yeah, so Gary Oldman discovered this, these resources like water and trying to start a town and maybe start another town. So through this, he wants to do it through the Bible. He said that's one of the reasons for in the past that people have been able to band together, and obviously we can see.
Obviously, he wants them for selfish means. The movie never hides the fact that Gary Oldman's a very evil person who he wants to use religion for bad. And if you've seen any of the posters, his thing, religion is power. That's what he wants. Power. So on one hand, you have this kind of idea that religion can be the root of all evil. But oddly enough, and people have been writing about this, it's a little contradictory, and maybe it's a statement on religion itself, which is one of the most contradictory things in the world. So, I mean, you almost can't blame the movie. At the end, it's presented religion, which is to say knowledge, right, is just as powerful for good. So,
yeah,
I at once appreciated the double standard and was a little irritated by it. Just because it seemed like Gary Whitta, who wrote it, didn't want to take a stand. But the more I think about it, the more I appreciate it.
Yeah, and as Dan said, this whole, there's, if you're kind of atheist or something, and you're kind of like, you don't like to be preached to and stuff, the first half of the movie kind of, when you find out it's the Bible and stuff, you're kind of hesitant. And then, we talked about this before, when Gary Oldman starts to talk about, how powerful it didn't have to be the Bible. It could have been
anything else.
And just how powerful words can be. It kind of opened my mind. And I've grown up, with a Christian background, just thinking about if the situation were to take place and literally no one had anything to believe in,
And one of the more annoying things about this movie, though, for me, is that for a movie that talks so much about the power of story and the power of words, it itself isn't really strong on either story or words, right? Like in dialogue scenes, I kind of was waiting for them to end.
Yeah, exactly.
When Denzel starts kind of reciting biblical passages, they're biblical passages that everyone knows, which in a way is just annoying because, I don't know, yeah, I get, like, you know, because it's like, I understand that these people wouldn't know what these things were because they you know all the Bibles were burned and he is the last Bible on the earth, like, you know, that's like what's assumed, which is ridiculous in his own right, but ignoring that ridiculous fact, reciting lines that we know make it seem cliche. Like, I would have rather would have found kind of more obscure lines to also kind of hold the secret of the Bible. Like, things like, you know, the kingdom of heaven, like, you know, I will not, you know, I walk in the valley of the shadow of death. Like, what? Like, we know what that is, even if they don't. So for the viewer, yeah, mix it up a little bit. So that was a little annoying. And even Denzel's delivery was kind of, it felt a little tired, you know. Maybe because Eli's tired.
And, I mean, the twist at the end is that he's blind.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Bro.
I know.
Spoilers. I know, but yeah, no, he's totally goat blind.
Yeah, and I like the way that scene was kind of composed with, because, you know, it flashes from Gary Oldman, because he has the Bible now, at the end of the movie, right, and he's about to open it, and then it flashes to Denzel, who discovered this new, refugee, or at Alcatraz in San Francisco.
Right. Yeah, he discovered this, out in the water.
Yeah, it's kind of like Children a cultural.
Style, he discovered a new.
Yeah, it's kind of a cultural place where they have, they, or they brought.
They're, you know, restoring, yeah, they knowledge.
Have, yeah, which I thought kind of funny because they had a Bible from every other religion, and like, I guess they didn't need the King James.
Well,
that's
kind of the thing. It almost like, it's at once, it renders it completely important and completely unnecessary.
Yeah. If then I mean, every other culture piece except the Bible. Like, I feel like right. There's enough.
Well, like I said, I mean, like, we were joking. I mean, you have the Torah,
yeah,
and you have the Quran. Do you need the Bible?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, like, you kind of have both parts of the Bible. But,
yeah, so he's blind. And I think, because while I was watching the film, I was like, all right, this is a good film, but I would never kind of watch it again. You know, I kind of get it. And then at the end, the blind thing happened, and it kind of makes me.
If only to see. But here's the thing, though. The hook of the movie, though, and yeah, there are scenes, I guess, that make sense, like, oh, he's blind, that's why this didn't happen.
Yeah.
But there are other scenes that their explanation for why it did happen, even though he's blind, like there's a shootout scene in which he kills every single person with pinpoint accuracy, and you're like, and so when you go back, like, if, you know, if I want to, the implication, obviously, being that literally, like, God is guiding him. Right. Like, he's a Jesus figure, you know, he's, or not even a Jesus figure, more like a Moses figure, you know, kind of carrying, literally carrying the word across a desert, you know, like over a sea, whatever, you know, like, cool, that's cool, but like, I mean, you know, it's a stretch, you know what I mean, like, okay, yeah, okay, so, you know, he gets shot at, for example, you know, Gary Oldman's like,
which kind of ridiculous scene,
he's like, kill him, please, whatever, and then Ray Stevenson, the Punisher, shoots at him and it like misses him. It goes through his jacket and he shoots him again, or his pack. Shoots him again, goes through his pack. And it's like, and then Denzel Washington turns out and just blows away everyone, and everyone's like lighting him up, and he doesn't get shot. And you're kind of like, you know, how? You know, so
yeah, and
I mean,
yeah,
and so it's a one way street.
You have to believe. You have to believe.
It's a one-way street.
As the tagline would say.
I don't know. Like, and the thing about this movie is it just doesn't take a stand on how realistic it wants to get because, you know, like, the realism of cannibalism is presented, and it's pretty effective. It is.
And then there's sequences where...
Listening to his iPod.
Yeah. Or sequences like the scene with he goes to a house and he finds the two older people, right. And it's kind of a ridiculous scene.
Ridiculously darkly comedic. Doesn't fit at all. Michael Gambon's like this... fucking redneck Glenn Beckian, you know, and he injects
a ton of humor at the just like, yeah, like the span of like 4 and like 5 minutes,
yeah, but then like those people who deliver the humor get blown away,
yeah,
so it's almost like fuck comedy, you know, but
I like the way they did it. There was a lot of, it was a brutal movie, like there were scenes with,
it was surprisingly brutal,
yeah, like where Solara
Kunis
is like gonna get raped, and then out of nowhere the guy goes.
An arrow goes through the guy's
Precious style when the guy's about to unbutton his, you know, the arrow. Yeah,
is nothing like Precious.
No, I know. So, well, it's the shot.
I'm offended. I'm just kidding. No,
and then the scene like Ray Stevenson when he kills that guy out of spite, you know, after he just
right, shoots yeah, which like, is ridiculous. That was also ridiculous. Yeah. Ray Stevenson turns on the end, yeah.
But it's
Book of Eli.
Yeah, you know? And the whole scene where Mila Kunis takes over. Oh, I was going to ask you this. Mila Kunis takes over. She gets captured. They Gary Oldman's crew tries to drive her back. She takes over the car they're in, blows up another car. They turn around. And how does she know how to drive a car? I was wondering that. Because, like, do you think she, you know, it's 30 years in the future. There's only a couple cars.
Well, exactly. There's a lot of talking about. Yeah. There's a lot. And when you make a movie like this, these are the things you have to just be aware of either explaining or that critics are gonna question.
Now, did you... There's a couple scenes like that where they didn't, like, she explodes.
Like, why does Solara have eyeliner and makeup? And why is her hair perfect? Yeah. And why is she the most beautiful person in the world, even though she was born after the world technically ended? Like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just things that you need to just address, you know?
Yeah, there's a little, like, it didn't bother me so much, but, the scene where they go down, they find the water, and then he locks her out. Like, how does she get out of there? And, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, they kind of, like...
Whatever. I don't care about that, but yeah, I guess.
I don't know, there's...
I mean, Hitchcock did shit like that all the time, yeah. But whatever.
Whatever. So, I don't know.
What's funny about this movie is I was talking to someone, and I said it was a fun movie, and it kind of made me... Because it's kind of... I mean, is it fun? But it's enjoyable. We settled on the word. It is an enjoyable movie. Like, I did not regret seeing it, you know, and you know, definitely the twist helps. Denzel Washington just kind of being... a leading man helps.
And I like the religious themes in it. I mean, to tell you the truth, I thought about this movie more than I thought about The Road after watching it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I haven't seen The Road, I've read the book, but I haven't seen The Road.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, The Road, it's great, it's bleak. It does, I mean, if you like Book of Eli without the action parts, without, I mean, I don't know why anyone would like just, you know, the parts without action, but that's kind of what The Road is, just kind of very,
so The Road sucks.
It does what it wants to very well, and so they're two very similar movies, which is kind of, that's a couple of reviews were like, well, The Road came out this year, so Book of Eli sucks, like, you know, it's like, I read a couple of reviews like that, it's like,
I hate that.
It's
like, I mean, does Deep Impact suck because Armageddon came out in the same year,
like,
you know?
10 years from now, when people revisit The Book of Eli, which, you know, they'll, like, people gonna, you know, no, I'm just kidding, you know, it's just
kind of,
I hate
no,
that.
No, I agree, the comparative things kind of always... You know what I mean? I feel like not worth it.
Yeah.
But no,
check it. Dan's right. Check it out. It's enjoyable.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, not a
especially for
a
Jane
masterpiece, but
and congrats to Gary Wood, best opening of the decade so far.
Good for him. but a surprisingly good opening. Almost 40 million in 4 days.
I'm surprised.
And it cost $80 million though. Can we just quickly say the blue screen at the end of this movie, I don't know, I guess they just ran out of money. It is so bad. I almost threw up in the theater.
Yeah. Because that, like, the scene on the bridge and looking at it was good, but it's particularly the one shot when they're in the boat and you see Alcatraz.
Yeah, they're
in a boat
going to Alcatraz, and literally it is like a 1950s movie.
Yeah.
Like when they're in a car and it's just, you get, like, it's almost worse because it's in color.
And a couple scenes, because the whole movie, there's, the clouds are kind of, like, moving, the same direction, I think, as Denzel, and it's kind of like,
Zell.
And that, the stuff where there's just, characters and the clouds are moving, it's kind of, it doesn't look great. But there's enough stuff in the movie that does look great, like, production.
Yeah, and, like, Gary Oldman,
you
know, he phones it in, but Gary Oldman phoning it is, like, a good actor giving a great performance because Gary Oldman's the man. So he does a good job, and you know, I don't know. Ray Stevenson is badass, and Mila Kunis is hot.
Yeah,
I mean, Mila Kunis is not a good actress, but not yet. You know, but she's very attractive. So, see if you got a couple hours, whatever. It's enjoyable.
Yeah. Alright, so this wraps up the Film Stage podcast.
Yes, it does.
And next week we'll be back. We're going to talk about Extraordinary Measures.
And?
Legion. It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be...
I almost can't wait.
It's going to be biblical. Quite literally.
Yeah, so if you guys have any questions or you want us to talk about a movie, a news story, we'll talk about whatever you guys want us
literally,
to talk about.
Let us know.
Give us
a topic.
Email jpraup@thefilmstage.com.
Or DJ Mecca. TheFilmStage.com.
Or you can ask a question on Twitter, twitter.com/TheFilmStage.
Yeah. Or me, DJ Mecca, MECCA.
Yeah.
DJ MECCA.
Yeah, so thanks for listening, everyone.
Twitter.
And, yep, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Later.